open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
But little did they know that in the wings, there was a Kennedy who was going to do more for them and for this population than I think any single individual has done in American history.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author and journalist Eileen McNamara says Eunice Kennedy Shriver was a unique individual who never let convention get in the way of saying what she meant.
She was arguing, why can't Maria be an altar boy? Well, when Maria was a little girl, I don't understand why Maria can't be an altar boy.
Yeah, that's pretty much how she talked. I listened to a lot of tapes of Eunice in the course of my research. She had a very distinctive voice.
Eunice Kennedy Shriver was the sister of President John F. Kennedy and Senators Robert F. Kennedy and Ted Kennedy. With her husband, Sergeant Shriver, she had five children, including journalist Maria Shriver. Eileen McNamara worked at the Boston Globe for 30 years as a reporter and columnist. Her latest book is called Eunice, The Kennedy Who Changed the World. Eileen talks this hour with Interlochen Public Radio reporter Morgan Springer. Morgan asked Eileen why she gets angry when people lump all the Kennedy sisters together.
Because they were very distinct personalities, and Eunice was distinct among them. Most of the sisters were sort of ornamental. They accepted that role in the family, that their role was to stand behind Jack or Bobby or Ted when they were running for election. And Eunice was a very different animal. She was a political creature in her own right. And this book is an attempt to set the historic record correctly, that she wasn't just somebody's sister or somebody's wife or somebody's mother. She was a person in her own right.
And where does she fit in the Kennedy family?
She's the exact middle child. So if we have any middle children in the audience, the overlooked one, the forgotten one, the three oldest Kennedy children included Rosemary, her sister who was born with intellectual disabilities. So Kick kind of took, Kathleen took the place of Rosemary in their parents' estimation. They were called the Golden Trio, Joe Jr., Jack, and Kick. And they were a lovely, social, athletic, accomplished trio. And Eunice was only 18 months younger than her sister Kick, but she wound up at the children's table with her much younger siblings. So she was always spending her life trying to figure out, where do I belong? And in a way, it was a gift, because by not fitting in anywhere, she found her own distinct voice.
And she was often paired with her sister, Rosemary.
She was. Rose Kennedy established early on that Rosemary would be Eunice's responsibility. And Rosemary was, her intellectual disabilities were actually fairly mild. She didn't have great physical coordination, though. So Eunice, who was the best sailor in the family, was required to take Rosemary along on all of her races, most of which Eunice won. But late in life, she complained vociferously to people that she would have won many more races had she not been required to take Rosemary.
The kind of the central argument of your book is that Eunice Kennedy Shriver, of all the Kennedy siblings, she made the most lasting impact on the world. Which is a bold argument.
It's a pretty audacious statement. But it doesn't minimize Jack or Bobby or Ted to say that I believe I can make that case. Of course, Jack and Bobby were cut down young in life. We don't know what they would have accomplished in their life. Senator Kennedy left a long and distinguished legacy, we know well in Massachusetts, of legislation, great social accomplishments. What people don't know is many of those pieces of legislation he filed because Eunice told him to. She was a force of nature, and she was 11 years older than Teddy. And he revered her, and he listened to her. And when she put something on his agenda, it stayed there.
But a big part of it is her work with people with intellectual disabilities.
It is.
And where she took the country from the time that she started working to when she died. And what was it like when, before she even started her work, what were the conditions that she was witnessing?
Well, it's interesting. Because the women in the Kennedy family weren't really seen by Joe, who was the patriarch, and by patriarch, I mean he spoke and they listened. So she didn't really have any stature. She wanted what was being given to Joe Jr. and Jack, that grooming for a political career. She would have loved it in 1946 if Joe Kennedy had selected her to run in the 11th Congressional District instead of Jack, but he, of course, did not do that. So what she did when she was told that real power wasn't for her, she took it. She basically hijacked the Kennedy Foundation, which was a charitable organization that the family set up after Joe Jr. was killed in World War II. And she took total control of that, and she turned it from a rather unfocused charity onto this issue exclusively. And she distributed millions of dollars for research into intellectual disabilities that the federal government wasn't funding, that nobody was funding. And she created a groundswell for scientific research that had not been there before.
And she, so you say in the book that in part she's fueled by her rage at what happened to Rosemary, which maybe you can elaborate a little bit about.
When Rosemary was 23 years old, she was starting to exhibit signs of mental illness as well as intellectual disabilities. She was violent. She lashed out. She hit her siblings. She hit her parents. They were finding her increasingly difficult to control. I think a lot of it was that she was coming into her own as a young woman. She was 23 years old. She was discovering her sexuality. She was also not unaware that her brothers and sisters had a much richer life than she had, that they could do things that she was not allowed to do. So she lashed out. And Joe Kennedy's response was to fix her. And the way he chose to fix her was to submit her to this experimental psychosurgery, prefrontal lobotomy. And it left Rosemary unable to speak and unable to walk.
Do you, when you think of Eunice's rage, the fuel of her rage, who is she mad at? What is she mad at? Is it her father?
Well, I think there's no question that it's her father, but I think we don't see that in her letters. The Kennedys are notoriously not self-reflective. So she kept diaries all of her life, but they aren't about her internal feelings about things. They're all about external observations. But I think what we see in her public life is this enormous rage at a society who diminishes people who may not have all the capacities that other people have. And she revered life, all life, and thought it should be treated with respect. She thought America wasn't living up to its promise of full equality for everyone. And that rage you could see directed at Capitol Hill or at the White House or whoever was not giving the appropriation that she wanted passed. But I think there's no question that part of it was a private internal rage, not just at her father, who made, I think, a well-intentioned but disastrous decision about Rosemary, but at herself and her siblings, who went along, were complicit in the fact that Rosemary was locked away for 20 years and had no contact with her family. Why? Because it would have interfered with Joe's plans for Jack's political career. She was a young adult, Eunice. She could have made a decision to stand up to her father, and she didn't.
And Rosemary's situation was not that different in terms of being institutionalized, being hidden, than other people at that time with intellectual disabilities.
It's true. And when Jack was in the Senate, the very first piece of federal legislation came before the Senate that would have given federal financing for special education teachers. It's hard to remember, but we didn't have special education teachers. And Jack Kennedy was on the committee that was hearing testimony for advocates for that bill. And he didn't stick around to hear the testimony. And the advocates were enraged because they knew what the country did not know, which is this issue had touched their family. But little did they know that in the wings, there was a Kennedy who was going to do more for them and for this population than I think any single individual has done in American history.
I want to kind of capture what Eunice is like, because she's so, the way that you capture her in the book, she's so unique and fiery and impatient, and she gets things done. So I want you to read a passage from the book, which I marked for you.
Okay. This is my first reading.
In the passage, it's mostly a description of Eunice through the eyes of her daughter, Maria Shriver. Do you see it?
Okay, I see. You start here.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. With her men's trousers, her Cuban cigars, and her role as the quarterback in the family's touch football games, she wasn't exactly like any other mother you've ever seen, her daughter Maria said. As a young girl, I didn't actually know how to process her appearance much of the time, because most of the mothers were dressed up and neatly coiffed. When Eunice, on the other hand, arrived to pick Maria up at the Stone Ridge School of the Sacred Heart in her blue Lincoln convertible, her hair would be flying in the wind. There usually would be some pencils or pens in it. The car would be filled with all these boys and their friends and their animals. She'd have on a cashmere sweater with little notes pinned to it to remind her of what she needed to do when she got home. More often than not, the sweater would be covering a bathing suit so that she could lose no time jumping into the pool to beat us all in a game of water polo. If Eunice defied categorization, she also modeled commitment. That summer, when Maria was 15, her mother sent her to Tunisia on a service project. I'd like to complain that there was no running water, no toilet. I was sleeping with five men, and she'd say to me, I don't want to hear one more yip out of you. Get your job done and don't come back until you're finished. Maria said, I've heard, I don't want to hear one more yip out of you all my life.
She accomplished so much. She founded the Special Olympics.
She
directed the Kennedy Foundation money towards research for people with intellectual disabilities. How did she was also a great lobbyist.
Right.
How did she do it? How did she do it all? Was it just her impatience? Was it that she had access to money?
I don't think it hurt that she was rich.
Yeah.
So Kathleen Kennedy Townsend said, one of the things you have to think about when you look at our family is our mothers didn't raise us. Despite all the mythology about Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy being the national matriarch, she was in Paris a lot while they were growing up. Her daughters emulated her. Eunice didn't go to Paris to buy fashion, but she went to work, and she had nannies who were there for the kids. She wasn't a particularly demonstrative mother. She wasn't affectionate in the way that Maria and the boys say they might have liked. But she showed her love and devotion to them in other ways. She used to kick them off the couch if they were sitting there watching television. And her favorite expression was, get on to yourself. What the hell does that mean, get on to yourself? I asked all five children, well, what did that mean? And they said, we didn't know what it meant. We knew it meant get out of the house, work, contribute, do something. And we did. They did.
Yeah. And they played a lot, too.
Yes.
All of them.
Yes.
Like poetry competitions at dinner and games and games.
Yes. She emulated lots of the things that had happened in her own house growing up.
Yeah. She married Sergeant Shriver. They had five kids.
They had five children.
I got that right. There's this scene in the book where Bobby Shriver, Eunice's son, he hurts himself while they're playing touch football.
He does.
And he starts crying. And Bobby Kennedy, Eunice's brother, says, Kennedys don't cry. But then Sergeant Shriver comes over and picks up Bobby and says, it's okay, you can cry, you're a Shriver. And I feel like that's so, it's just like, it's one of those telling details about the family. But what does it tell you?
It tells you everything about the Shrivers and the Kennedys. Bobby Shriver was a competitive little boy, but according to him, Bobby Kennedy laid out that football field in Hyannisport so that he would run a pass that would inevitably lead you toward the rose bush. And you had a choice, fall into the rose bush and suck it up, or not catch the pass. Either one would have been unacceptable in the Kennedy family. So more than once, he landed in the rose bush. And when he cried, his uncle told him that Kennedys don't cry. And Maria says that her parents basically had their roles mixed up, that Sergeant Shriver was the maternal one in the family, and that she was the tough guy. She would have been with Bobby Kennedy saying, you know, get out here, stop crying. Mm-hmm. But Sarge, he added that necessary balance to that house. He really nurtured those children, and why they're all successful today.
He sounds like a saint in the book. Is he?
Do you know? I mean, I loved him. Boy, bring him back. Yeah. He was a lovely guy. He was also madly in love with her. He used to stand at dinner, at the dinner table, with a glass of fine French wine and toast the most beautiful woman in the world. And I would say to each of the children individually when I interviewed them, and then your mother, of course, would rise and say, and everybody laughed, and said, no, no, Mommy never toasted Daddy that way. They were a wonderful spiritual, religious, and political partnership. And he adored her. He adored her. She loved him in her way, in the way that Eunice could love someone.
Tough love, action.
Tough love, action, work, work, work. Yeah. It's all about work for Eunice.
She worked so hard, and yet she didn't have the same opportunities as her brother. There were roadblocks for her as a woman. What were they?
Her father didn't see her. She was invisible. Her ambitions, she was different from her sisters in lots of ways. I mean, she went to Stanford. She finished up her college education at Harvard. Her sisters went to convent schools. She really wanted to have a public life. It wasn't widely available to most women in that era, but it was especially not available in the Kennedy family, which their philosophy basically amounted to men play and women pray. And she wasn't buying it. She prayed plenty, but she wanted to be an actor on the public stage. And so she did it in the only way available to her, which was behind the scenes.
Maria Shriver said that her mother was maternal feminist?
Yes.
What did she mean by that?
Well, you know, just last year we had that great March for Women in Washington. Eunice wouldn't have been allowed to march with that group, because they excluded anybody who didn't support abortion rights. Eunice was an ardent feminist. She believed in full equality for women. She believed in equal pay. She lobbied for those things. Way before the women's movement, she was arguing for a federally funded childcare for women who worked and for a welfare system that allowed women to stay at home and take care of their children. She saw women whole, I think. Her objection to abortion was two-pronged. I mean, it was partly religious from her Catholicism. And the other part of it sprang naturally from her affinity for this population she spent her life defending. She saw abortion as an existential threat to a fetus that had intellectual disabilities. And as we started to get genetic testing, she proved prescient on that point. 90% of fetuses with Down syndrome are aborted in this country. And she didn't think that equal rights for women required support for abortion rights, that we should have a bigger tent. But we still don't have a bigger tent because, as I say, she wouldn't have been allowed to march for women in that march last year.
Did she see it as like eugenics when we're talking about abortion and people with intellectual disabilities?
Well, I think, you know, she knew the history of what happened to this population. And eugenics is not like very far in our history. It's, you know, it became a big philosophy in the beginning of the 20th century, and it saw a genocidal impact during the Nazi era. So she was very, very aware of the history and was reluctant to see it, us go backwards instead of forward.
One of the things that stood out to me, well, she was Catholic, she was religious, she was fighting to be seen in a man's world and following a religion that has a very strong male hierarchy.
Right.
Was that at odds for her?
It wasn't. I mean, she was arguing, why can't Maria be an altar boy? Well, when Maria was a little girl, I don't understand why Maria can't be an altar boy. Why are only the boys allowed to be altar boys?
Is that how she talks?
Yeah, that's pretty much how she talked. I listened to a lot of tapes of Eunice in the course of my research. She had a very distinctive voice. And she, I think she bristled. She bristled at the idea that women couldn't be priests. Hers was a different kind of Catholicism than Rose's. Rose was a very pious, church-going Catholic. She went to Mass every day. So did Eunice, every day. But that wasn't the heart of Eunice's Catholicism. Action was the heart of her Catholicism. Social action, social justice. Be the change you want to see in the world. That's who she was, and that's not who Rose was.
I want to talk about your writing process. Yes. it took 2.5 years for you to get access to 30 boxes of Eunice's uniquely scribbled notes.
Indecipherable handwriting, yes, yes.
So you knew that you wanted to write the book, and I'm wondering when you knew and why you wanted to write the book.
Well, I knew enough about her. Because I worked for the Boston Globe for so long, it was impossible to have a career for 30 years there and not encounter the Kennedy family. I first heard the word most often used to describe her from Senator Kennedy when I covered Congress for the Globe, that she was formidable. Basically, don't cross my sister. So I had some sort of fleeting contact with her. I didn't know her, but I covered press conferences she participated in, that sort of thing. Her death struck me as interesting. She died 2 weeks before Senator Kennedy did. And he was a lion of the Senate. His 47 years deserved all the attention that they got. To acknowledge her is not to diminish Senator Kennedy in any way. But she was buried from a small clapboard church on Cape Cod. Special Olympians attended. Yes, Oprah Winfrey and Joe Biden were there too. But it was a little church, and she's buried in a little churchyard. A group of Special Olympians threw their gold medals into her grave in a spontaneous act of love for her that no one saw because there were no cameras there. When the senator died 2 weeks later, there was a procession from Hyannisport to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston, where he lay in repose. And thousands of people passed by his bier to say goodbye to the senator, after which he was flown to Washington. And he was driven to the Capitol, where his colleagues came onto the Capitol steps to bid him farewell. He's buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Eunice is in a little churchyard beside Sergeant Shriver. I read both of their obituaries, and they were both memorialized on the front page of the New York Times. But in Senator Kennedy's obituary, there were enormous number of photographs of members of the family through the years, from their childhood to their later years. And in all the photographs, the women were misidentified. Eunice was identified as Kathleen. Rosemary was left out. Eunice was in a picture. I saw her, and she was identified as Patricia. And I just thought, wow, it's 2009, and we still can't see these women as distinct individuals. And it pissed me off.
So then Eunice, her work was inspired by rage.
Yep.
I'm wondering if your work is inspired by rage.
That's a really good question. You are not the first person to have seen that little...
Yeah, a little bit.
It is very frustrating to see women in history be overlooked. And her legacy is just so enormous. I mean, her hands are on everything. From that very first bill in 1975, which guaranteed a child with intellectual disabilities the right to a seat in a public school classroom, to the American with Disabilities Act. She had a hand in all of it, and no one knew it. I didn't know the half of it until I started looking at it. She got to most of the most important pressing social issues in this country decades before her brothers did. She was working at the State Department in 1945. That's 2 years before Jack Kennedy arrived as a member of Congress in 1947. In 1947, she was working for the Justice Department on issues of juvenile delinquency. She ran a task force there about this issue. Bobby Kennedy didn't discover that issue till 1961. In 1950, she worked in a federal penitentiary for women, where she made friends with World War II spies who were in there for treason and with murderers, and many of whom came to her wedding in 1953 after they'd been paroled. Seriously.
And ate at her kitchen table.
And Ted Kennedy was a huge champion when he was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, when I covered him, for prison reform. Well, that's great, Ted, but she was there 30 years ago. Where were you? In grade school, probably.
So how did you tackle writing the book?
Well, writing the book was the very end of a long process. The Kennedy family, as you might imagine, is suspicious of journalists. Why do you want to write about my mother? Do you know something I don't know? Because if you're writing a Kennedy book, it's got to be scandalous, right? Maria was open, sort of, to this idea that certainly they thought their mother deserved a full biography. They're very proud of their mother. But it took a while. There's five of them. It's like herding cats. So trying to get everybody on board and on the same page took a while. And then getting access to her papers was an issue because they hadn't read them. So are you really going to turn over 33 boxes of material that you've never looked at to essentially a stranger? And I tried to make the argument, yeah, that was a really good idea. It took a few years, but I did prevail, and they did give it to me. And they know a lot about their mother now that they didn't know before I opened those boxes. And they didn't, they asked, but of course I said no, could they read the manuscript before publication, because that's not how it's done. They had to trust me. It was an enormous act of trust, and I'm eternally grateful for it, because we wouldn't know her story if I hadn't got into those boxes.
And do you think they would have ever taken the time with those boxes?
No. You know how you feel about your own parents? You think you know everything about your own parents. And even if your mother is Eunice Shriver and your father is Sergeant Shriver, there is this sense that they're just mom and dad. So I don't think so. And I don't think that they could have looked dispassionately at that material. One of the sons, Mark, wrote a lovely, lovely memoir of his father that is called A Good Man. And I recommend it to any father in the room who, if it's just a wonderful testament to what a great dad he was and what a great human being he was. Maria may one day write one about her mother. I'm not sure what it will be called. It won't be called a good woman. It will be called a fierce woman or a formidable woman. It won't be called a good woman. And she may well do that. And that will be a great addition to the canon of Kennedy memoirs. But this is a different thing. This is a really, I tried to approach this as a historian would, an impartial biography of a remarkable woman.
Were you researching and then writing? Was it all mixed up together?
Oh, I couldn't write a word until I knew her. And I feel like I know her as much as you can know somebody in this way, retrospectively. But it's such an arrogant presumption to think that you can ever really know somebody that you didn't know in life, that it took me a long time to actually get to the computer to sit down and begin to say what I had to say about her.
And what would a writing day be like?
Apply, ask to chair, write.
So that hard.
I mean, I think there's this notion that there's something romantic about it. You know, you have to be sitting in Donegal looking out at the sea or something. And I'm sure there are much better writers than I that do it that way. But for me, it's a work. So you just sit down and you do it.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I loved the writing of it. There were times in the research when I was ecstatic because her papers were so chaotic. You could turn a page of crumbling news clippings, you know, and find her bridal registry and discover that the World War II spy gave her stationery from Tiffany's as a wedding gift. And that was like a moment, you know, wow, you know. So that I could float through the day on that one. But you never knew. There were days you didn't find anything. And then there were days, I mean, there was a British MP, a Tory member of parliament, who was madly in love with her. Well, I never knew that. Her kids didn't know that. And his love letters were beautiful.
Like
she never wrote back.
What would he say?
Oh, he would just say that, he accused her of terrible cruelty because on the phone, when he was telling her from London, and think this is in the 40s, transatlantic telephone call isn't cheap or easy to accomplish. While he's like pouring out his ardor for him, she was assessing his speeches and she told him they stunk. So,
a blunt lady.
She was a blunt lady.
Yeah.
She was a blunt lady.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Eileen McNamara talks about her role in the Boston Globe's coverage of the Catholic Church sexual abuse scandal.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Morgan Springer's conversation with Eileen McNamara, author of Eunice, The Kennedy Who Changed the World.
So you grew up in North Cambridge,
I did.
In Boston, also Irish Catholic.
Yes, I did.
Eileen McNamara.
Yes. It's a good tip-off,
isn't
it?
It's a good tip-off,
yeah.
What was your childhood like? What were your aspirations as a kid?
So I grew up in the district that Jack Kennedy represented, that after Jack represented, Tip O'Neill, the former Speaker of the House, represented. Tip O'Neill used to drive my sister to drum and bugle corps practice at St. John's Church with his daughter, Susan. But he wasn't a family friend. My father was a postal clerk. and we didn't move in those circles. I never anticipated going to college. I don't know what I thought my life would be like. I went to a small Catholic school, taught by nuns mostly, a couple of lay teachers.
There's a, you're the first person in your immediate family to go to college.
I am.
And there's a woman who is the impetus behind you going to college. Can you tell them that story?
You like
so
that
good.
Story.
I love that story.
Well, because there was no precedent for it, I mean, the McNamaras didn't go to college, or at least our branch of the McNamaras didn't go to college. But when I was a freshman, in my freshman English class, I had a lay teacher, was also an Irish Catholic, who was married to a young man who was getting his PhD in physics at Harvard, the other end of town, where we did not venture. And she thought I had potential when I was 14. And she said, we're going to get you out of here. And I didn't really know what that meant. But she only taught for a year. And then she had her first child, and I became their babysitter. And when I was a senior in high school, she handed me an application to Barnard College, which I'd never heard of.
In New York.
The Women's Undergraduate Division of Columbia, which I'd also probably never heard of. And just to give you an idea of what this Catholic school was like, where very few people went to college, maybe Boston College, a boy maybe went to Boston College, and a girl might have gone to one of the Catholic girls' schools. I went to the nun who was the guidance counselor, and I asked if I could have a catalog for Columbia, and she asked me why I wanted to go to school in South America. Sister Margaret Ann, God rest her soul. So I was naive, and I was all out of context. So I applied because my teacher told me to. And I got in, and I didn't get a scholarship. So I called her heartbroken. Well, I got in, but I didn't get a scholarship. And she said, well, you could cry about it, or you could do something about it. And I'd never been out of North Cambridge. And she told me to take a bus to New York and go tell Barnard College to give me a scholarship. And I did. And on the bus, I marked up all the places that it said nobody will be denied admission to Barnard because of financial need. And then, with the innocence of youth, I walked into the president's office of Barnard College, expecting that she was free and would see me, because I had just taken a Greyhound bus from Boston. She wasn't free. But her secretary happened to be named Helen McCann, another Irish Catholic, who said, I'll get you in, dear. And I got in, and I showed her all these passages, and she was quite lovely to me, and then said, I better get back on the bus, because I had told my parents I was spending the night at a girlfriend's house, which I told the president of the college for reasons I can't quite explain. And I went home, and soon thereafter got a letter telling me I had a full scholarship. And I was so full of self-congratulation. Is there anyone more persuasive than I? And then I graduated from Barnard, and in my exit interview with the financial aid officer, he had my file on his desk, and I can read upside down, which is how I knew I would be a reporter. And it said, do not disclose. And I said, do not disclose what? And he said, well, have you invited Margaret Foyer to your graduation? And I said, how do you know the name of my English teacher from my freshman year of high school? And he said, because she paid for your first year at Barnard. It's a remarkable story. And suddenly everything made sense. All those phone calls. How are your grades? How are your grades? How are your grades? Because she had made a deal with Barnard that she would pay for my first year, and if I made a certain grade point average, they would pick up the scholarship, which they did. So But I didn't know that. If you do read Eunice, you will see her in the acknowledgments, Margaret Foyer, because I made several trips out to Stanford in the course of my research, but there was one piece of information I couldn't get when I was out on one trip, and I was too cheap, frankly, to make another trip to California. So she lives in Palo Alto. So I called her up, and I said, how would you like to do some research for your former student? So she went to Stanford, and she found some information for me for this book. So she's still in my life, obviously.
She also, you made a promise to her.
I did make a promise to her on graduation day that I would pay her back every nickel that she had spent on me. And she said, no, you won't. You'll wait, because someday Eileen McNamara will cross your path. And when she does, you'll do for her what I did for you. And it took 12 years. And I spent a year at the Boston Globe writing about the way judges in Massachusetts treated battered women in the courtroom, which was to say they battered them again. And they didn't protect them when they needed protection. And I was steered to the judges who were dysfunctional in this regard by a young woman who was an advocate for battered women. She wasn't a lawyer, she was a volunteer who did this on her own time. And one day we had lunch, and she was very excited to tell me that she had gotten into law school. And she was very excited. She'd gotten into New England School of Law and Harvard and Northeastern, and she would probably go to the New England School of Law. And I said, wait a minute, I think I heard Harvard in there. Did you get into Harvard Law School? And she said, I did, but they gave me a full scholarship to the law school, but Sarah was herself a battered woman. She had left an abusive husband, and she had a young child. And she made her living by cleaning people's houses. And that money she was using to send her son to a very nice private school in Cambridge. So there was no possible way that she could afford rent, because Cambridge even then wasn't cheap. So I had just had my first child, and I was working as a reporter, and that means you don't make a lot of money. And I had to go home that night and say to my husband, remember the promise that I made to Margaret Foyer that I told you about? And he said, oh, please, not now. And I said, yeah, we have to pay Sarah's rent while she goes to Harvard Law School. And we did. And, and Sarah, of course, has done it for someone else. Who has done it for someone else? Who has done it for someone else?
So you graduate, you become a reporter, you go back to school, to Columbia, to journalism school, right. And then eventually you end up at the Boston Globe, which is where you wanted to be.
Yes.
And you're a secretary, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what you wanted to be.
No, I can't type. I still can't type. I typed this book with two fingers, as I have typed everything I've ever written in my career. So I had no aspirations to be a secretary. But when I graduated from journalism school in the 1970s, they weren't lining up to hire women to be reporters. I started work at the Boston Globe as a secretary on the very same day as a classmate, a male classmate, started as a reporter. Yes, rage is something I have some familiarity with.
And how did you feel, like what was your approach when you were working? Was that rage an outward thing, or was it a put your head down, suck it up, do the work?
Well, I would tell you that I put my head down and I sucked it up and I just did the work. But anybody that I worked for at the Boston Globe would say, oh no, no, she did not hide the rage at all.
What would you do?
Well, I was not an easy employee, you know. Why has he got that story? Why didn't I get that story? Why do you send him to murder scenes? Why don't I get to go to murder scenes? That actually had a very funny ending, that story. I was annoyed that when I finally became a reporter at the Globe, they put me on the night police beat, which is where everybody started. And I noticed I never got sent out on the good crimes, you know, the gruesome ones that had a chance of making page one, which is all you cared about when you were a kid. And so I complained about it, and my boss was a very crusty old guy named Bob Anglin, who was the Night City editor, and he said, "You want to go to murders? I'm going to send you to murders." So he would find the really gruesome ones, you know, people who are hog-tied and things, and he would send me to those. And unbeknownst to me, Bob Anglin was a regular at a liquor store called the Harvard Wine, which was my father's night job. My father was the counterman at the Harvard Wine, and that's where Bob Anglin bought his booze. So Bob Anglin would come in, buy his booze, and he knew my father as Danny, the counterman. And so one night, my father says to him, Bob doesn't know he's my father. He says, "I've been noticing that you've been sending this young woman, somebody named Eileen McNamara, out to a lot of gruesome murders at night. Like, what is up with that?" And Bob Anglin said, "Oh, Christ, you don't know Eileen McNamara. You could send that one." And I believe he was going to get very graphic about where he could have sent me. And my father said, "That's my kid." And there was hell to pay for me that night when Bob Anglin showed up at work. "Why didn't you tell me Danny was your father?" I said, "Because I didn't know that's where you bought your booze."
One of the biggest stories you were involved in is the coverage of clergy sexual abuse in Boston. What was your role in that?
Well, I had a role with a lot of people throughout the 90s, a lot of reporters and columnists. These stories would break hither and yon. There was no coherence to it, but there would be priests who would be picked up and charged with child molestation, and none of us had put the pieces of it together yet. But in the summer of 2001, there were some court documents in a case against a priest named John Gagan released, which indicated that since 1984, Cardinal Law knew that John Gagan had been accused of molesting children and had intentionally moved him from parish to parish. And essentially, this one document that was in the court file acknowledged that the cardinal knew. There were several other cases that were about to go through the courts of priests accused of child molestation. But we couldn't see those records because Catholic judges had acceded to the request of the Archdiocese of Boston and sealed the records. So we couldn't get to them. So I wrote a column on a Sunday in July saying, if you think that John Gagan is the only priest, you know, we're deluding ourselves, that until somebody has the courage to challenge the court seal and demand access to those court records and the personnel records in the archdiocese in the public interest, we'll never know whether this is just the tip of the iceberg, but we have lots of reason to suspect that it is. And as it happened, we were getting a new editor at the Boston Globe the very next day. So Marty Baron was the editor of the Miami Herald, nice Jewish boy from Miami, didn't know anything about Catholicism or the Archdiocese of Boston and didn't care. And he showed up at my desk his first morning at work and said, "I read your column, and I don't get it. Doesn't the Globe ever sue to get court records?" And I said, "Oh, we sue all the time to get some court records. We're talking about the Archdiocese of Boston." And he said, "Yeah, so?" And then after someone revived me, after I fainted, I said, "That would be awesome, Marty." Like, yes. Several of us at the Globe have been asking for years for us to do just that. And the editor of the Globe went to Notre Dame. I leave it there. So it never really was going to happen, and it happened instantly. And the funny thing about that day was at the end of the day, Marty came back to my desk to say, well, you're going to be really happy. I went to the publisher, and we're going to sue to get those records open. And I said, that's great, Marty. Now, when are you going to assign the spotlight team to go find out what's the bottom of this? And he did.
So as
great
spotlight,
editor, that'll tell you what a great editor can do. One man, one woman changed the world. So can one man.
Yeah. And so did you know that the spotlight team was investigating?
I knew. Yes, I knew
or
that.
Or was that a secret? Did they keep what
well,
they were
Well, mostly
on
what
secret?
The spotlight does is always a secret, mm-hmm. except I said, Marty, you should assign the spotlight team.
Yeah, yeah.
And the next thing I knew, the spotlight team was in his office. So I thought, oh, he's probably assigning the spotlight team to do this. I think it was a pretty open secret that they were looking at it.
Does that mean once they took the story and they were finding out all these things, you didn't get to know about it?
No, because, you know, I was a columnist, but I'm a reporter first. You know, there are certain kinds of columnists who sit in armchairs and pontificate. Nobody reads them. Good columnists are out in the street and they're doing reporting, the same reporting they would have been doing otherwise, but they do it with a point of view. I mean, I think that's what a good column really is. So I was reporting even as the spotlight team was reporting.
On the same?
Yeah. I mean, we were tripping over each other. And then when the records opened up, well, yes, the spotlight team was looking at the records, but once they were open, they were open. So I was looking at them too. Yeah. So we were everybody was all over it.
You won a Pulitzer for your commentary writing in 1997.
I did.
You're still writing commentary sometimes for WBUR, which is Boston's NPR station. They have a blog called Cognoscenti.
They do.
The most recent one that you wrote in December is about Cardinal Law, who was the head of the Archdiocese.
Yes, the late, not lamented Cardinal Law. Yeah.
Well, as you say, and he had, on that day in December, he was being buried in the Vatican and being blessed by Pope Francis. And can you just read what you wrote after that?
It was not enough that the misguided men of Rome provided Law a safe haven at a Roman basilica for 15 years. After the depth and breadth of his obstruction of justice was exposed, they have to honor the unindicted co-conspirator in the sexual abuse of children with a saint send-off in the sacred seat of the Roman Catholic Church. It astounds the imagination. Even among those of us who thought all the Pope's men had long ago exhausted our capacity for outrage, let's leave it to the New York Times and the Washington Post to refuse to speak too ill of the dead, to balance the ledger with an even-handed accounting of his good deeds and bad. In Boston, Law deserves an obituary as unvarnished as his rank ambition and craven evasion of responsibility. I wasn't a fan.
No? I mean, and then you go on to talk about all his misdeeds.
Yes.
Yeah. You don't hold back.
Well, I mean, I think there are times to hold back. And I think probably as a general rule, it isn't good to speak ill of the dead before they're in the ground, at least. Mm-hmm. But I think he was an exception to that rule. Yeah. It was an exception to that rule.
What is the key to good commentary writing?
Passion and good reporting. It's great to have powerful opinions about things, but if you don't know what you're talking about, who cares? My father taught me how to be a good reporter when I was a kid. We didn't have dinner table conversations like the Kennedys did, but my father was very passionate about public affairs. And he worked, as I said, at the post office during the day and at this liquor store at night. So the only real time he had to himself was at the dinner table when he read the Boston Evening Globe. No accident, I became a reporter. Not unlike Eunice, I wanted to get my father's attention. Mm-hmm. So if I had a byline, maybe he'd notice I was around too. My first job, my chore as a little kid was to go down the three flights of stairs and get the Evening Globe off of the front porch and put it beside my father's paper, by his dinner plate. We weren't allowed to talk during dinner because he was reading the sacred Boston Globe. And if you did talk, he did this on the side of his plate. So there were four kids, and we learned to be quiet, and we learned to have some kind of reverence for the newspaper and for news and for informing yourself. And years go by, and the Vietnam War is raging, and my brother Dan is in Vietnam, and I have a dissenting opinion about the war from my father. And he would, at that point, willingly have a conversation at the dinner table. But before you spoke, he would say, "Remember, I don't care what you think. What do you know?" And I never forgot it. And I took that caution with me into commentary writing. I mean, really, who cares what I think? I'm just one person writing opinion. What do you know? Tell me something I don't know that you know, and tell me how you know it.
So you did all this research on the book. Yeah. You wrote the book. It's kind of a simple question, but I want to know, do you like Eunice?
Oh, I admire her enormously. I admire her enormously. I like her more than she would have liked me. And I know that, and that was a hard thing to know. She revered athletics. She was energetic about most things. I'm pretty slothful, really. I don't play tennis. I don't sail. I do know how to swim, but I couldn't catch up to Eunice even when she was in her 80s, I'm sure. So I'm sure I would have been intimidated as hell by her. And she would have thought that I ought to get up and get on with it, right? Get on to yourself. But of course I like her. Of course I like her. I think she paved the way for me to do what I do, for all women to do what we get to do in the world now. Had she been born a few decades later, who knows what she would have done? Who knows?
All right.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you.
That was Eileen McNamara talking with Morgan Springer. Eileen McNamara's latest book is called Eunice, The Kennedy Who Changed the World. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.